proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot in the news that we'll be getting to today as we move along. Pat Leahy talking about contempt of Congress citations. That's going to have to wait, of course, until Congress comes back into session. The fellow who's heading up the National Bureau of Mine Safety, his mines before he became a huge Republican contributor and thus, without the approval of Congress, became the head of the safety organization, had about twice the safety violation rate of any of the norm in the industry. So a lot of interesting stuff out there, and that we're going to be covering today as well. Marjorie Cohen is going to be with us in the second hour, the professor of law and constitutional scholar, and Jeffrey Cohen in our third hour, the former producer over the Donahue Show and founder of FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Right now, Kristen Fife is with us. She's a senior writer for the Culture and Media Institute. The Culture and Media Institute, a conservative organization that is concerned about the S-CHIP program, the State Children's Health Insurance Program. Kristen, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And I, your website is cultureandandmediainstitute.org. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
Okay, great. And your objection to the S-CHIP program seems to be on very interesting grounds. We've heard from people before who object to it simply because they see it as another aspect of creeping socialism. You know, the government passing out one more dollar to the people can't have that. But your concern seems to be more directed toward the fact that you believe that this bill, because it's going to cover more children, is going to lead to more abortions. How is that possible?
Well, there's devils in the details, as they say. There's some language that was changed in the S-CHIP bill that fundamentally looks at opening the door that wasn't otherwise open. Previous to this current version of the S-CHIP bill, which, if my sources are right, President Bush is planning to veto, changed some language. Back in, I think, 2002, he had declared a child, in quotes, a being that exists from conception through the age of 18. That language was taken out of this particular bill so that the coverage would be for a, in quotes, pregnant woman.
Right. Now, if I may interrupt you just for a moment, and let's just clarify and expand that for our listeners, and also just, you know, I'd like to make sure that you and I are on the same page, because maybe I'm misunderstanding this. My understanding is that the change that the Bush administration made in that legislation and the Republican Congress in 2002 was that a fetus or an embryo or even a blastocyst could be protected under S-CHIP, literally from the moment of conception to the moment of birth, but in many cases the mother herself could not be covered. And this has led to a situation where in some states, mothers are being denied things like anesthesia during childbirth, access to prenatal care that has anything to do with their health. Like, for example, if the mom has diabetes or stuff, but their fetus is theoretically and practically, actually, in some states, in Texas, for example, eligible for medical care. And some legislators thought, this just ain't right.
There's two ways to slice every story. I would think that any doctor practicing responsible medicine is going to ensure that the mother who is carrying a child who is covered, even as a blastocyst, because everything that's going to be that person is contained in that blastocyst in terms of DNA and all those other things that inform the growth of the being. Any responsible doctor is going to make sure that the person that is tasked with making sure that that life gets to be a life, out of the womb, is going to give them the care that they need.
But he won't get paid for it. And with these changes, then it's because basically what that change in 2002 did is it was part of this larger program, this larger, I would say, agenda that you have of establishing clear personhood for a fetus at any state or for a, you know, we lack a good word because at different stages of development, they're called different things. I know it's shorthand to call it fetus, but fetuses describe a very narrow spectrum of the total 9 months of gestation. But, you know, that, let's call it an unborn child, to use the language that you're probably most comfortable with, that the goal of this, my understanding is that the goal of this is to make sure that the mother is covered as well. What's wrong with that?
There is nothing wrong with covering the mother, but it does take the coverage of the unborn child out of the equation.
Because the child is no longer defined as a child, because the mother would have to qualify for some sort of, you know, poverty level health care, because just the fact that she's pregnant, which raises, I think, a larger question, and that is, I agree with you and many folks in the pro-life or forced abortion movement or whatever you want to call it, that a fetus at the ninth month, at the eighth month, at the seventh month, a fetus that is viable outside the womb should have substantial legal protections. I agree with that position. I think most Americans agree with that position. And certainly that's, by and large, the law across the United States. But a blob of tissue that's eight cells, that's smaller, or 16 or 32 or 20 or 256 or whatever, that is smaller than the period at the end of a sentence, why should that blob of tissue have legal rights that, in the case of the current S-CHIP program as modified by Bush and the Republicans in 2002, exceed the rights of the mother?
I don't know that you can necessarily say that it exceeds the rights of the mother, because
it has access to funds that she doesn't have.
Both of the people who currently live in my home, who are now 13 and 10 years old, were those 8 and 256 globs of tissue at some point.
Right.
Every human being that walks the face of the earth was an 8-cell and 250-cell blob of tissue at some point. People don't procreate things other than people.
So that's what we're talking about
time, really. The only difference between you and me and the blob of tissue, as you say, is time.
Right. So what we're really arguing about here, and I'm not even sure argument is the right word, is when does life begin? I mean, that's really the issue. And there are some folks, and actually, you know, one of the other things that you put forward is you're very concerned about the fact that the abstinence education, as a consequence of the expansion of the S-CHIP program, may end up in the hands of Planned Parenthood. And there are people, and you know, we've had them on this program, who are part of the pro-life movement, who suggest that life doesn't begin at implantation in the uterus. It first of all, that it begins at the moment of fertilization in the ovarian, in the fallopian tubes. Now, there's no way that blob of tissue at that point is viable. It has to first implant in the uterus. And then there are others who suggest that life doesn't even begin there. Life begins when people start thinking about having sex. And then there are others who suggest, and with this, you know, very seriously, actually, it's more or less the position of the Catholic Church, that life begins, the life of the children begins at the moment of marriage, because that's when God has decided how many babies you're going to have. And if you engage in birth control, you are messing with God's will. Where do we draw the lines here? Shouldn't we have a discussion in the United States again, like we did back in the 70s, about when life begins and what protections at various stages of life these blobs of tissue, all the way to the spectrum of a baby that could be viable, you know, when it's born, are available?
I think we are having that discussion, aren't we?
Well, you and I are, but I never hear it in the mainstream media. All I hear is people shouting at each other about it's alive, it's not alive, it's alive, it's not alive.
Well,
and I think
you make a really good point, because that is on a whole host of issues. Our ability to dialogue with each other in any kind of civil form anymore, we've gotten so vested in our partisan views, and you know, if I give you the courtesy of hearing out your argument, that must necessarily imply that I'm agreeing with you. The civil discourse is something that we need to get better at, and especially on issues like this that are really very culturally significant.
Yeah, I don't disagree. It seems that, you know, George Bush's veto of this S-CHIP legislation, in some part because it expands health care, and, you know, that's satisfying the economic conservatives. But frankly, I'm guessing that in large part his veto is going to be to satisfy you and the factions within the religious conservative community, or however you might prefer to characterize it. I think that that's a reasonable characterization. Is really what it's about. And there's not much discussion about that. And B is that an appropriate thing? And And gee, I'm sorry. I thought we had another minute. We're out of time. But Kristen, people can read all about it over at your website, cultureandmediainstitute.org, your take on this, the senior writer for Culture and Media Institute. Kristen, thanks a lot for an interesting conversation.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
I appreciate your coming on. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program right here on Air America Radio.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
You know, I realize this is one of the more culturally divisive issues. And I think, frankly, that's one of the reasons why we need to be talking about it instead of not talking about it. I know that there are talk show hosts out there who have an absolute policy of not talking about abortion, for example, or not talking about gay marriage. And I'm not one of them. I think that these are issues that are helping define our times. They are issues that have to do with our past, our present, and our future. There are issues that have to do with, you know, how we think of ourselves as humans, as citizens, as people, and what, you know, what kind of society, what our values are in society. And obviously there's a whole spectrum of values that go even, you know, way beyond that, way beyond these simple issues. You know, for example, what about the millions of children who are already born who don't have access to enough to eat? I mean, this is the you know, it's just kind of this, you know, very, very simple issue, it seems, and yet nobody's talking about the hungry in America. 10 million people. This is from Science Daily. 10 million Americans, almost 4 million children, don't get enough to eat, according to a new study from Cornell University and the National Center for Health Statistics and the Centers for Disease and Control and Prevention. Now, this is actually a study that's a couple of years old, but, you know, the information, I'm sure, is it's actually worse now than it was a few years ago. More than half of the 4% of Americans who say they are sometimes or often hungry live in households and at least one person has a job. This is not the unemployed. And it's not Reagan's stereotype of the African-American welfare queen with a Cadillac that never existed, by the way. After he told that story 3 or 4 times, all the news folks said, okay, you know, show her to us. She didn't exist. But it's not. 4.5 million of these literally hungry people who are employed and yet don't have enough to eat are non-Hispanic whites. 2.4 million are blacks, non-Hispanic blacks. 2.4 million Hispanic citizens of the United States. This is a study that was not looking at non-citizens, although, you know, rates of hunger probably in that community are even greater. So, you know, here we have legislation that in 2000 was modified by the Republicans to give the rights of personhood to a fetus from literally from the moment of conception. And there's an argument about that. Does that mean the moment that the egg meets the sperm in the fallopian tubes? Now, it's 3 days later, 3 days after that happens, that fertilized embryo actually implants itself in the wall of the uterus, in the lining of the uterus, and then can begin growing to be a baby. For those 3 days, it's in limbo, as it were, you know, to borrow a phrase, and is not, there's no possibility that it could become a human unless it implants in the womb. You know, certainly outside of the mother, there's no possibility. And the Republicans came along in 2002 and said, no, we're looking for ways to give personhood rights to even two cells, even one cell. Well, I guess a fertilized cell becomes two cells. And rather than going back around about the back door, which is what they've been doing now for the better part of 15 years, step by step, you know, chipping away at this thing, and they did it, as I said, in 2002 with the S-CHIP program, and this Democratic version of the S-CHIP program that Bush is going to veto undoes that. Rather than doing it that way, I think, frankly, that they should just be upfront about it and say, okay, this is what we're about. That they're about saying that, as basically the Supreme Court recently said, and certainly Scalia is on record as saying, that the rights of six cells, eight cells, well, it would be multiples of two, right? or multiples of four, I guess. The rights of 4, 8, 16, 32 cells trump those of the rights of the mother. And this is the argument about Plan B, for example. Plan B is a pill that causes, that prevents an egg that has been fertilized by the sperm up in the fallopian tubes from implanting in the uterine wall and thus beginning to grow and become a fetus. Right? It prevents it from happening. Is that an abortion? There are some people who think it is. There are other people who say, no, it's not an abortion. And if we're going to give personhood rights to fetuses, should we have funerals for miscarriages? And, you know, I mean, this is one that really is up close and personal for me. Louise and I have three children, and she was pregnant for a fourth, what would have been our second, and miscarried, and I think it was her third month or thereabouts, second or third month. And it was a big deal. I mean, it was a very painful thing. But do we take it the step beyond that? And do, I mean, you know, like here you had Rick Santorum, whose wife had a miscarriage, and he took this little, it wasn't quite like a person yet, and I don't know, pickled it or something, and took it home and showed it to his kids and held it on this, put it on the mantle for a while. I mean, it's like, how weird does it get? And what do we do about this in America? And how can we figure out a way to juxtapose? If we're going to talk about the morality of childhood, the morality of how we as a society treat children, whether they're you know, fully born children or whether they're potential children, how do we pull together the issue of hunger in America, for example, poverty in America, and the issue of abortion? 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman broadcasting live from the mothership here, our headquarters at Air America, the network. Woohoo! Says Chris Lopresto. and hello to Lauren Kirshner, who's also taking your calls and keeping everything running smoothly here. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com and airamerica.com. You'll find our blog over at airamerica.com and links to our live chat room and our message boards that are over at tomhartman.com. And I'm in town because last night attended a screening, and thanks to all the people who showed up. It was great meeting you all at the Landmark, where down in the East Village, the Landmark Sunshine Theater, where Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour, is playing. And it's not just because I'm in the movie that I think it's such a big deal. This movie picks up where Al Gore's movie left off. It's absolutely brilliant. And tonight at 9 o'clock at the Tank down at 279 Church Street, there's going to be a discussion, an in-depth discussion of the film, and I believe that they're going to be screening selected clips from it. But it's all operating on the assumption that you've actually made it over to the Landmark Sunshine and the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas, the two places where the 11th Hour is opening or is playing here in New York City, and seen the movie. Even if you haven't, feel free to drop by. Go to screeningliberally.org is the website, and you can just click their RSVP thing there. It's real simple, and they'll just send you the information on how and where and when and everything else. I've been talking about the S-CHIP program. This in the New York Times today, apropos of our conversation. As I said, this is not just a one-dimensional argument or debate or discussion or whatever the Bush administration is having. The Bush administration continuing its fight to stop states from expanding the popular state children's health insurance program, S-CHIP, has adopted new standards that would make it much more difficult for New York, California, and other states to extend coverage to children in middle-income families. What? Somebody earning $30,000, $40,000 a year wants to have their child's insurance paid for by The taxes on Rush Limbaugh? We can't have that. After all, he only made $170 million. I mean, you're going to leave him with only $150 million? I mean, what's going to happen here? Yeah. See, I think we should raise the income tax back to where it was when Dwight Eisenhower, that great liberal Republican, was president. 1-866-303-2270, our number. Bonnie in Princeton, New Jersey. Hey, Bonnie, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you. And thanks for what you do.
You're welcome. I'm happy.
And I only get you on Sirius, and I wish I could get Air America back.
Well, you'll have to take that up with Sirius. I'm sorry. But in any case, your comment was about abstinence education?
Yes, it was. Actually, one of the points that you made, and I hope the gentlewoman that you were speaking to is still listening, and I'll just narrow it down to one, was about the abstinence-only programs, which have, through many scientific studies, been proven not to work. Not only unwanted pregnancies, but STDs and so on and so forth.
Right. What the science is in, and there's no debating the science, frankly, and it's rather shocking that children, young people who go through abstinence-only sex education programs in public schools are more likely to engage in sexual activity than children who go through normal sex ed courses. It's just that there's a difference in the sexual activity. It tends to be less, shall we say, normal intercourse and more, let's say, non-reproductive varieties of same that are equally dangerous at transmitting diseases. And these kids actually end up with higher rates of sexually transmitted diseases. And even though they may be having less vaginal intercourse, they're having higher rates of unintended pregnancies. And you know, all the more the disaster. It's, you know, good intentions. What's the old cliche? The road to hell is paved with good intentions, and it certainly is there. By the way, with Sirius, we are on Sirius. We're live on Sirius Satellite Radio right now, and they replay the show in the evening. So and we're on XM as well. Kat in Madison, in the evenings. Kat in Madison, Wisconsin.
Hi.
Hey, Kat, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's such an honor to speak with you. You're such a brilliant guy, first of all. I wanted to respond to one of the comments your guest said, which just had me shrieking like a banshee here in Madison. She said that there was no difference between an 18 to 16 cell blastocyst and her child. And all I could do is say, no, 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 no. There's a woman involved there somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, and that.
Well,
and
I think probably she was, in her own mind, inserting the words religiously speaking or philosophically speaking.
Absolutely, but practically speaking.
Yes.
If you just had a 16-cell blastocyst sitting in a petri dish on a lab bench, it is not going to develop into a child.
Right, and it's not going to need its diapers changed.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think in this whole discussion, there's such a total dismissal of the role of the woman, and it really bothers me. I mean, a fetus, every single cell in that fetus has come from the nutrition intake of that woman.
Right.
Now, her womb is a miracle, honestly, and to just completely disregard that she is co-creating this fetus,
yeah.
I think is just a disservice to women.
Well, and in fact, there's a long tradition of this. I believe it was Van Leeuwenhoek, although I may be wrong. It's been, you know, 30 years since I took biology, but it was around the time of Van Leeuwenhoek, you know, when the microscope was first invented. Mm-hmm. Up until that point in time, the assumption was that sperm were actually fully developed little human.
Yes, the animalcules.
Yeah,
yes.
the homunculus, is it, or you know, whatever it was called.
This
little tiny. They visualized it as a little tiny human,
right.
And the woman's womb was just considered basically like a toaster oven.
Right, and a fertile ground.
Right.
She was like the earth.
And in fact, there were even some concerns about masturbation and things like that. That mm-hmm. You might get people who were like dirt people or something because they came out of the dirt.
Right.
And they'd be these monsters, these kind of golem kind of monsters or whatever. Because it was because they just didn't think that women had that much to do with it. And it's just reflecting, a 7,000-year history of what we call Western civilization of patriarchy and domination of women, and it's unfortunate to hear women doing that as well.
Yes, but deliberate ignorance is not an excuse. I mean, we certainly know a whole lot more about it at this point. In fact, we know that the female, the egg, really contributes 99.99% of everything towards the development of the fetus.
Right, and 50% of the DNA.
Right, 50% of the DNA. But even then, I mean, it's once the sperm is fertilized, the egg, any reproduction of that DNA is because of nutrients from the woman.
Right, and also the woman contributes 100% of the mitochondrial DNA.
That's right.
And, we're getting into esoterica here.
Absolutely.
But good point. Kate, thank you. Thank you very much for the call. Renee in Springfield, Missouri. Hey, Renee.
Hey, I want to bring us back to a subject that I'm really glad to hear people starting to talk about. Instead of talking about caring so much about abortion, start worrying about the kids we already have today. And one of the biggest problems, this really, really sets me off, is starting to design programs for these children that are in foster care is going beyond making sure not just that they have the basic necessities like medical and food, but giving them an education past public schools. Let's make sure that they have the ability to get to college.
Yeah.
Because once these children are dropped off in the foster care program, you have the problem with abuse in the foster care program. I'm from Springfield. We have the Dominic James case here. They're left alone. They're forgotten. And they become a public nuisance sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we need to go beyond just the basic needs, and we need to pay more attention to their social structure.
Yeah, we have in my mind three major problems, and I say this as somebody who has, worked as a consultant in the educational field, who was the founder of a school for learning disabled kids, the Hunter School. You can find it on the web at hunterschool.org, a school for ADHD kids. And as the parent of three kids, one who went through public schools, one who went through a private school, who was homeschooled. So I've seen it all and done it all. And I spent a number of years out there just doing workshops and seminars and trainings for teachers and school districts and wrote 7 books on this. That we have three major, actually there's probably many more than that, but some major deficiencies. Number one, we're not even educating kids in our high schools about the basics of life. They don't know how to change a diaper. They don't know how to balance a checkbook. They don't know how to apply for credit. They don't know how to have a relationship with another person that works. We don't talk about these things. I mean, way beyond sex education, we don't even talk about that stuff, number one. Number two, virtually every other industrialized country in the world provides for free college education. It's absurd. If it's not even going to be free, then at least it should be cheap. I mean, up until the last 20 or 30 years, it was possible to work your way through college with a minimum wage job in the United States. From the founding of this country right up until then, the old land-grant colleges in the 1800s, Michigan State University that my mother graduated from and I briefly went to, it was possible, it's just not anymore.
Well, it's extremely difficult because I, too, have ADHD, and it took me 7 years to get through school as a full-time and a parent, single parent. It was very difficult to get through school, and it was a struggle for me.
Yeah.
And half of these kids are going to have these problems as well. And you're right. We need to concentrate on these things if we're going to make them valuable.
Absolutely. And thank you, Renee. And number three, by the way, my third point is we now have this cookie-cutter approach to education, that our schools are factories and kids are items on an assembly line, and everyone should look like ticky-tacky, and they should all behave just the same. And it's nonsense. It's why we have to dump No Child Left Behind as fast as we possibly can. 45 minutes past the hour.
Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you here on Air America Radio, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, airamerica.com for our blog. Check it out. Lee, driving in Colorado, listening on KKZ. And hey, Lee, what's up?
Just a couple comments. I really liked when you used examples kind of like real world, like what happens if cells are granted personhood? Are you going to have a funeral? for a miscarriage. I read an op-ed piece in Newsweek several weeks ago that I really liked, that if you grant personhood to cells and the mother uses Plan B or something happens, how many years should she serve in prison for that?
Right. Well, you know, when I did this show from the Republican National Convention, what, 3 years ago was it now, I think, whenever it was, here in New York City, I was on a radio row that was just solid conservatives. I think I was the only guy there who was a liberal, and there might have been one other. And the RNC was just shoveling conservatives in front of me one after another, and they had no idea who I was. It's just, and this one guy sits down with this big pro-life button on, and I said, so what's your position? And he's like, well, you know, life begins at conception, and to take a life is murder. And I said, okay, so if that's the case, I'm assuming that you think that abortion doctors should be given the death sentence. And he said, yes. And I said, now, if I hire somebody to kill somebody, I can get the death penalty in most states that have death penalties. Do you think that how do you think that women should be handled who, you know, hire an abortionist? Should they be hung? Should they be shot by a firing squad? Should they be given lethal injection? Should it be the gas chamber? And with a totally straight face, he said, I think it's up to the states.
Right, and I think the part of the op-ed piece in Newsweek, there was a study done where people went around asking people their position on abortion, and if they said, yes, life begins at conception, they asked a series of questions ending with, well, how many years do you think the woman should serve in prison? And they were just absolutely speechless, most of them. People that hadn't even thought about
it. That's why I say we need to have this discussion in the United States, because, as I said, I agree that a viable unborn child, and I think that you can actually use that language with some rationality, has rights and should have rights, you know, some substantial rights. On the other hand, I think that, you know, six cells or eight cells should have substantially fewer rights, if any. And you know, there is a spectrum of viability here. It's been recognized by the world's religions forever. It's been recognized by law in the United States from Roe v. Wade forward. And what's happening is there's a group that is trying to wipe away that distinction.
Well, I also agree that abortion, I'm against abortion, but I don't think the state...
We're all against abortion.
That's right. And the last thing real quick is George Carlin, I heard a number of years ago, came out and started his act here in conservative Colorado Springs, which is kind of like Orange County, and came out, and his first thing he talked about was how concerned right-wing conservatives are about you before you're born. But once you're born, F you, you're on your own.
Yeah,
It was a great line. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Sure enough. Thanks, Lee, for the call. Gene in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Gene.
Hey, Tom. I enjoy listening to your show. I don't agree with you very often. You mentioned
In that case, special thanks for listening.
Okay. I believe that your credentials in education sound outstanding, not just the work you've done, but the personal experience with the homeschooling, private schooling, and public schooling. And apparently you started a special school. I commend that. What I'm wondering is you obviously see that not everybody, and you talked about no child left behind, less tube than that. I kind of agree with that. But you talked about school isn't for everybody, and the same school isn't for everybody. Is compulsory education, should that go away? You know, the same grade 1 through 12 for the same kids, that there's no difference?
Yeah.
Is there a way to take care of kids that aren't going to make it in school?
Yeah,
not ruin their dignity and so forth?
Yeah, this is a question that I've frankly struggled with much of my life, Gene, because, yes, I think that there's an interest in society. All of us have an interest in making sure that everybody has at least a minimal level of competency when it comes to reading, to understanding civics so that they can vote and make rational decisions as members of society, to understanding math so that they can participate in the economy and open a checking account. You know, some basic stuff. When we lived in Germany, it was very interesting. In the second grade, our middle child, Justin, was in the second grade the year that we lived in Germany, 1986. And that's the year when the parents and the teachers sit down and decide whether the child, from that point forward, literally starting in the third grade, from that point forward, is going to be on the Hochschule track, the track that leads to college ultimately, or the Realschule track, which, as I recall, I may have the words backwards, that leads ultimately to trade school and to becoming a skilled tradesman. And
well, what a great idea. Is that irrevocable? Or, I mean, you know, could you go along and have Johnny brighten up and really want to get back out of trade school and into academics?
Or yes, it is. It is. It is possible to jump tracks in Germany as you get, you know, as you get older. It is possible. It's difficult. It's Germany, of course. You know, it's like, you know, yeah. The answer to every question. Every time I didn't understand something when we lived there, the answer was always, well, we've always done it that way. but you know, I thought that was an interesting, you know, process that they had, and they really are physically two different schools. I mean, you physically, and there's no shame associated with being in the Realschule or the Volkshochschule, or no status associated with it either, because skilled tradespeople actually can make a good living, and there's, you know, it's the solid middle class there. And a doctor, by the way, is making about as much as you know, somebody at the top of their trade as a tool and die maker.
Exactly. And the kids are excelling where they are, not someplace else.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And I'd like to see more flexibility brought into our public schools. But the compulsory education in the United States has a very checkered past. Horace Mann was an advocate for this back in the 1880s, before we had compulsory education, because, and he was selling it to industry, because he said that it would provide for compliant laborers for the factory. He was selling it to government because he said it would make people less likely to rise up. And the first community to go along with public education, compulsory public education, was the Boston area. And that was because the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, which was a Protestant secret society, had taken over the Massachusetts legislature. And they were really worried about the fact that Boston was largely Catholic. And the Catholics were now into their second generation. It was the second generation after the Great Potato Famine. And they were now American. And they were starting to gain political power. And they were worried, they wanted to maintain Protestant political power in Massachusetts. And so they saw compulsory public education as a way of breaking the bond between the child and the family by stating to the child at the age of five that the state was more powerful than the family. And, you know, that's always spooked me. I actually wrote about that. There's a whole chapter about that in my book, Tom Hartman's Complete Guide to ADHD. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. One of my very favorite people, and just a real expert and authority on the areas of constitutional law and law in general, the president of the National Lawyers Guild, a professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, Marjorie Cohen is with us. She is also the author of Cowboy Republic, the book Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. Marjorie, welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Tom.
So glad to have you with us. I have a bunch of questions for you, and in addition to, you know, just getting into the Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. The first is, what are executive orders? How did they come into being? What authority do they have, and how can they be overridden? It seems that Bush has been issuing some fairly bizarre ones recently, like the one that says that they can basically shut down your checking account and your existence as a human being with regard to finance if they've decided that you are in any way not with the program, shall we say.
Executive orders don't appear in the Constitution. There's no constitutional authority for them. Nevertheless, presidents in the past have used them. And unless and until a court rules that they're unconstitutional, then they are, in effect, the law or have the force of law, even though they might really be unconstitutional. And Bush has certainly abused this power of issuing executive orders by issuing several, including the one that you mentioned.
Now, I understand that Franklin Roosevelt issued some executive orders that really upset the Republicans back in the day. And so this has been around for a while, hasn't it?
It has been around for a while, yes. But as I said, it's not provided for in the Constitution. The Constitution gives only the only lawmaking power to Congress. The only choice that the president has, or the only power the president has, is to sign or veto a law that Congress has enacted. He
right.
does not have the right to decide that he wants to follow only parts of the law. He has the duty to execute the law, to make sure that the laws are faithfully upheld.
Has the issue of executive orders, or for that matter of signing statements, Sam Alito's brilliant contribution to the Reagan administration and you know, now the just standard practice of the Bush administration, Alito now being on the court, have either of these issues ever been before the Supreme Court?
Not to my knowledge. The the constitutionality of executive orders, I don't think, has been before the Supreme Court. I know that signing statements has not. And although Bush has, other presidents have issued signing statements basically saying what they think a law they've signed into law means. No president before Bush has issued signing statements that contest so many individual provisions of constitutional law. He's used it more than 1,000 times. And although these signing statements have been there, the courts have not picked up on them. The signing statements have been used in dissents. I believe that's Scalia and or Thomas have used signings, have referred to signing statements that Bush has signed in their dissents, but the majority of the Supreme Court has never dealt head-on with the constitutionality of signing statements. But as you said, Judge Alito is very fond of them. And thanks to John Yoo, the infamous John Yoo, the architect of the torture memo, of the Patriot Act, of the secret spying program,
right. And now a professor at the University of California,
and now
Berkeley.
And now, of course, a distinguished professor. 6 weeks after John Yoo wrote a memo to Bush about the so-called unitary executive, those words started appearing in Bush's signing statements in several of them. And unitary executive is a very insidious concept. It sounds innocent enough, but it's an insidious concept that Judge Alito also subscribes to and Clarence Thomas, and that is that all executive power rests in the hands of the president, and indeed all governmental power rests in the hands of the executive.
Isn't unitary power another way of saying king?
It's another way of saying king. And so, for example, if Bush didn't like certain agencies, government agencies, including government agencies that Congress had set up, he could disband them. He could, under this unitary executive authority, he could disband the Environmental Protection Agency, the Food and Drug Administration. And it's very, very dangerous. And he's using this unitary executive theory to say, look, I'm signing this bill saying that we can't torture, but I'm the commander-in-chief. I'm the unitary executive. I'll do what I want. I will follow those parts that I want.
We're talking with Marjorie Cohn, professor of law, author of the new book, Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law, and president of the National Lawyers Guild. Her blog is, in my opinion, one of the very best. If you want to keep up on what's going on legally, it's over at marjoriecohn.com. It's M-A-R-J-O-R-I-E, and her last name is spelled C-O-H-N.com. And I just strongly recommend you check it out. Marjorie, or should I call you professor?
You can call me Marjorie.
Okay, thank you. The top story on your blog is about Pfizer revised a blank check for domestic spying. Two questions about this. One, I've seen a number of news reports recently that indicate that the new FISA bill that was passed by virtually all the Republicans in the House and Senate, and a small handful of Democrats, 16 in the Senate and 41 in the House, as I recall, that it not only allows George Bush to, say, for example, decide to wiretap Ted Kennedy's phone, and no one will ever know because there is no judicial oversight of the thing. The only person who would ever know would be Alberto Gonzalez, who obviously is not going to blow the whistle. But it also allows for things like body cavity searches, strip searches, absolutely, totally invasive stuff with no warrant, A, is this true? And B, how can this be in a nation that has the Fourth Amendment attached to its Constitution?
I don't know specifically, Tom, that this so-called Protect America Act of 2007, where Congress turned over virtual 100% of the authority to wiretap without a warrant to the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence and took it out of the hands of a judge where it was before, allows for body cavity searches and strip searches. But the Bush administration, in defending itself, defending Alberto Gonzalez against possible perjury charges, etc., has said, well, this is just one, this terrorist surveillance program, the secret spying that the New York Times broke the end of 2005 that Bush had been doing since 2001. That's just one of many programs, one of many secret orders that Bush has signed, and it may very well be that he has signed secret orders about doing body cavity searches. You know, not long after he said that we can't read people's mail, that we're not going to go that far, Bush issued a signing statement to a bill, a postal bill, which said that that they do not read our mail, saying that, in fact, there were certain situations where they would read our mail. So I I think that this is just the tip of the iceberg. And you notice that when these programs become public, it's because some conscientious whistleblower with a conscience has decided that, you know, the Constitution has just been shredded one time too many, and they blow the whistle and they reveal these programs. The data mining, for example, that was leaked to the USA Today. Who knows what else they're doing? Bush has really amassed unprecedented executive power, and it's very frightening, and it's also, to me, counterintuitive to think that he and Cheney would actually give up this power come 2008-2009.
Right. We're talking with Marjorie Cohen, and Marjorie Cohen, COHN.com, her blog, and an excellent one. And, in fact, your entry from Sunday, July 29th, Time for an Independent Counsel. Yesterday, Pat Leahy, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who had issued subpoenas for Karl Rove and for Alberto Gonzalez, and specifically in this case for information on this illegal spying program, this warrantless wiretap program, was not provided that information yesterday. Yesterday at 2:30 Eastern Time was the deadline. It was not forthcoming. Fred Fielding, Nixon's former lawyer, now Bush's lawyer, said, sorry, we can't get it together fast enough. And Leahy has said that he's going to put this before the committee as the first thing when Congress reconvenes. I think it's September 5th or September 6th, you know, right after Labor Day. What are his options? What are Leahy's options? We have about a minute before we've got to take a break, but you can stick around after the break and we can continue this conversation?
Yes.
Great, because
yes.
I'd like to get into your book as well. What are Leahy's options?
Well, if Leahy convinces a majority of the Senate Judiciary Committee to issue a contempt citation against the officials who are refusing to turn over this information, then it goes to the full Senate. If the Senate votes for this contempt citation, which I think is unlikely, I think the House is more likely to, but I don't even know if they would as well, then the law says that the U.S. attorney has to take this to the grand jury for possible criminal charges. But Bush has already said, you know, we don't agree with that law either. We're going to tell the U.S. attorney that it doesn't have to take it to the grand jury, and that leaves the power of inherent contempt, where Congress itself can arrest someone, try them on the floor of the Congress, and then if they're convicted, they can hold them in a cell in the basement of the Congress.
Right, and that hasn't been used since the 1930s.
Right.
But it's still there. And I guess the first question I'll have for you when we come back from the break is you know, what kind of traction is that getting? And then I'd like to get into the six ways that the Cowboy Republic has defied the law here. We're talking with Marjorie Cohen, C-O-H-N, MarjorieCohn.com, her blog. 16 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Marjorie Cohen, the president of the National Lawyers Guild, professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, and author of a new book, Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. And Marjorie, first of all, inherent contempt. You've talked about it. A number of, you know, it's been brought up a couple of times on Keith Olbermann's show. I'm not sure if you were the one who brought it up, but I think you're the one who first put the meme out there. Anybody in Congress nibbled on this fish hook here?
You know, I don't know. Keep in mind that the statement you made by Patrick Leahy in the Senate has to do with the wiretapping investigation, the secret spying investigation. The House Judiciary Committee voted articles of contempt against Harriet Myers and Joshua Bolten in the U.S. attorney firing scandal. And because Harriet Myers didn't even show up, and Joshua Bolten refused to turn over documents. And so now it will go to the full House in September when they come back from Labor Day to decide what to see whether a majority of the House votes in favor of contempt citations. Assuming that the majority of the House does vote for contempt citations, then it will go to the U.S. attorney, which Bush has basically indicated he will tell,
who's
he will instruct
a Bush appointee
to go to the grand jury. So then the question is, will the House of Representatives, because that's a little further along in the process than the Senate,
right,
vote for inherent contempt? And given the lack of backbone I've seen in this Congress, even the so-called Democratic-controlled Congress, I doubt that it would happen.
your blog, Time for an Independent Counsel, what is the difference between an independent counsel and an independent prosecutor? What was the law that was put into place after Nixon and that has since expired that was the authority, I believe, under which Ken Starr went after Bill Clinton to the tune of some $70 million worth of investigation? What's the difference, and what's available now that wasn't available?
Well, after the Watergate scandal, the Ethics in Government Act was enacted and signed by Jimmy Carter, and it had what was called a referral clause, saying that an independent counsel shall advise the House of Representatives of any substantial and credible information which such independent counsel receives in carrying out the independent counsel's responsibilities under this chapter that may constitute grounds for impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
So Ken Starr took that referral clause and basically went on a witch hunt leading to Bill Clinton's impeachment. And Congress, in reaction against Ken Starr's witch hunt, allowed the independent counsel statute to expire by its own terms in 1999. And so now what's happened is that the investigation of high government officials has been returned to the Attorney General, not a three-judge panel, which is what it was under this independent counsel statute. And the Attorney General has incredible authority. He can block any investigation he deems inappropriate. But the Justice Department regulations call for an appointment of an outside special counsel when three conditions are met. One, when a criminal investigation is warranted. Two, when there would be a conflict of interest, such as Alberto Gonzalez investigating himself. And three, it would be in the public interest to appoint an outside special counsel. And then when those three conditions are satisfied, the Attorney General must select a special counsel from outside the government. And certainly all of those criteria apply to Alberto Gonzalez at a minimum, and probably Bush and Cheney as well. But Alberto Gonzalez is not about to appoint a special counsel. Now, the Senate, the Congress, could appoint a permanent special counsel to investigate and advise them about misconduct by high government officials, but they would probably have to enact a new independent counsel statute, and many of them might still be smarting from the Clinton impeachment.
And it would take 60 votes to do it.
Yes, it would.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, exactly. The Senate asked four senators asked the Solicitor General in the Department of Justice, Paul Clement, to appoint a special counsel, and I think he probably just ignored them.
Yeah, so far as I know, he has.
Right. There's no way they're going to investigate themselves.
Right. The crimes of the Bush gang. The list that I have is that they've lied us into a war. They've caged over a million votes. They've violated the presidential records with regard to the RNC emails. The warrantless wiretaps, extraordinary rendition, violating habeas corpus, torture at home and overseas, and war crimes in the U.S. plus international war crimes. That comes up to eight, I think. What are the big six that you have, and where are our overlaps here?
Well, Tom, certainly there are more than six, but I didn't want to publish a book that was so thick that people would need wheels to carry it around.
So I
wanted something that would be useful. So I limited it to what I thought were the major six: the war of aggression, the illegal war in Iraq, the torture of prisoners in Guantanamo, Iraq, Afghanistan, and the CIA black sites, summary execution and willful killing, which is when they just assassinate anybody that they think might be a suspected terrorist with no due process, and then kill civilians in record numbers in Iraq, for example. The Guantanamo Gulag, where I include the Military Commissions Act and the indefinite detention, spying on Americans, which is the illegal surveillance program, and refusing to execute the law, which is the signing statements.
Oh, that's interesting. In the signing statement. That's a good one, too. I'll have to update my list. Marjorie Cohn. And if you want to read all about it, it's a great book. Cowboy Republic, Six Ways the Bush Gang Has Defied the Law. Her website, Marjorie Cohn, COHN.com. President of the National Lawyers Guild, Professor Thomas Jefferson School of Law. Marjorie, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
looks like the Quakers, the American Friends Service Committee, maybe can breathe a sigh of relief. Welcome back, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, toll-free nationwide, 1-866-303-2270. AirAmerica.com if you want to drop in and participate in our blog today or find the link to our live chat room where you can drop in and say hi or get over to our message boards over at TomHartman.com where you can write messages and talk with other folks and all that sort of thing. Anyhow, the Pentagon has been maintaining this database. It's called Talon, T-A-L-O-N, and it basically has been compiling data on anti-war groups and other organizations like the Quakers, the American Friends Services Committee, and monitoring anti-war activities, the organizations, people who go to peace rallies. Last October, I think it was, Mark Crispin Miller and I showed up here in New York City at the World Can't Wait Drive Out the Bush Regime gig that was in a church down around 9th Avenue and 20th Street or something like that. I forget exactly where it was or the name of the church, but I remember well walking over there, and it was packed. I mean, it was, you know, people not literally hanging from the ceilings, but close to it. Absolutely packed, and you wonder how many people were there from the Pentagon. How many people were there from the FBI? There were a lot of video cameras running, I can tell you that. There's actually YouTube video of both Mark's speech and my speech all over the web, and apparently all over the Pentagon. And so the Pentagon says now they're going to shut this down, and the analytical value has declined. This is why they say they're shutting it down. But they express hopes that a new system is going to replace it in the near future. In other words, they're not shutting it down because they've discovered that Americans don't like being spied on. They're shutting it down because probably there's so many anti-war groups and so many anti-war people out there, including within the Republican Party, that they can no longer maintain all the information in any kind of coherent fashion. Oh, man. 1-866-303-2270, Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We've spoken before about the signing statements, and Marjorie just mentioned that Bush said he could essentially open mail without a warrant, and I just wanted to give a quick update. As you know, I started a little online group, Postal Workers United Against Tyranny, and I managed to get a resolution opposing this policy passed both at the State Convention of the Letter Carriers, but also at the Washington State Labor Council Convention just this last week.
Great. Jeff, give us your website again, please.
Oh, sure. It's postalworkersunited.blogspot.com.
Okay, great. Postal Workers.
Or they can go to the State Labor Council page. That's wslc.org.
Right. Postalworkersunited.blogspot.com. And that's absolutely great. And the reception that you've been getting from letter carriers?
Oh, everybody's for it. I mean, nobody wants to be associated with this regime, and they certainly don't want their customers to think that we're opening their mail.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you very much, Jeff. I appreciate the call. Thank you. I will. And the decision ultimately that Congress is going to have to make is how they're going to deal with this, how they're going to deal with all of these violations of laws, all of these efforts at spying. And frankly, I think that the political decision that should be made is that they need to frame this in a political context. I have only heard this once. One time in the mainstream media in the last 6 months, and I have been suggesting this for the better part of 3 years now, since I first wrote an op-ed for Common Dreams about this, saying, they got picked up all over the blogosphere, the Democrats should be saying, okay, Bush is spying on us, he won't tell us who he's spying on, he won't tell us what the circumstances is, and he won't let a court overlook it. Could it be because he's spying on Ted Kennedy? Could it be because he's spying on senior Democrats in the Senate or in the House? Could it be because he's spying on Henry Waxman? Could it be because he's spying on John Conyers? Could it be because he's spying on Pat Leahy? And he doesn't want anybody to know, but he wants to know what they're doing, what they're up to. Could it be that that's why Bush is so strongly resisting any kind of oversight?
And I guarantee you, if the Republicans were in the minority in Congress right now, and Bill Clinton was president, and Bill Clinton was asserting the right to spy on any Americans, anytime, under any circumstances, open their mail, even arrest them and search their body cavities without a court order, without a warrant, without probable cause, none of that stuff. If Bill Clinton was asserting this, I guarantee you the Republicans would be yelling and screaming that he was doing it because he wanted a checkup on what the Republicans were up to. He wanted to be listening in on Republican strategy sessions. I guarantee you they'd be saying that. Why are the Democrats not putting this meme up? This is the simple way that everybody in America can understand what this is all about, or what it could be all about. It may well be that the Bush administration is only using this power to look for people that they think are potentially terrorists. But the fact of the matter is that the power is so broadly and widely construed that some future president, who may not be as ethical as George W. Bush. Excuse me, I have to slow down every now and then and pull my tongue out of my cheek. May use these powers, specifically the way Richard Nixon did, to spy on their political enemies. And there is no way anybody would ever know. And even if there's a whistleblower, the whistleblowers get nailed. I mean, here's another, this from today's Think Progress, the blog for the Center for American Progress. National Institutes of Health Agency suppresses whistleblowers by forcing them to record all contact with Congress. David Schwartz, he's the director of the National Institutes of Environmental Health and Sciences. It's a branch of the National Institutes of Health. And he's been investigated by the House and Senate. They're looking into whether or not he disregarded conflict of interest guidelines, breaking government spending rules, violating ethic rules, you know, the typical stuff that happens with Bush appointees. So under Schwartz, the agency is now requiring all of its employees to fill out a form to document all of their contacts with Congress. Obviously, why? Because he wants to know if any of the people who are working under him, three have quit their jobs in disgust. Morale's in the toilet there, by the way. He wants to know if any of the people working for him have had the temerity, the audacity to go talk to Congress about anything. This is, off the wall would be being gentle. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Listening to your show, it's got my blood just boiling, so I'm going to try to stay calm. So the last five elections have been wrought with vote fraud, election fraud, which is when you fast forward to 2006, the Dems should have had a supermajority, okay? Hmm. Prior to the elections, there was all this, talk about vote fraud and black box voting, the lady that did black box voting did a documentary on HBO about vote fraud. And then after elections, hardly any talk of the election fraud.
Right.
So now we have these Congress people that are sitting on their butts, allowing Bush, and his illegitimate executive branch to not only keep punching the American people in the face, by signing these executive orders and such. So now we have 8 months. The Congress is in recess. We need to figure out a way. You and Mike Malloy and John Elliott and everybody should put out the clarion call and get these political Congress people on the horn to explain why they deserve another term in this upcoming election. If they're allowing Bush to act like this quasi dictator, trashing the Constitution. Didn't they take an oath to uphold the Constitution? They violated their oath.
Yeah, uphold and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Yeah, absolutely. They have violated their oath, in my opinion, David. I don't disagree with you at all. And we have to keep in mind that a lot of these, and thank you for your call, we have to keep in mind that a lot of these folks think that they are there. Not a lot of them, probably a small minority, maybe 50 or so in the House of Representatives, maybe half a dozen or maybe as many as 8 or 10 in the Senate, think that they're there because of, quote, moderate elements in their districts. They think that they're representing their districts, and they think that that works because that's the meme that was put out in the right-wing press, was that, remember right after the 2006 elections? The meme that was put out was, those moderate Democrats won the day, and, the DLC and Harold Ford and Rahm Emanuel were out there saying that was it. Well, the fact of the matter is that it was the most progressive of the Democrats who won the biggest victories and with the smallest amounts of money. And those so-called moderates who did win won in areas where they spent more money than the progress than the true progressives did, and they won by smaller margins. And the Democratic Party needs to wake up to this. But frankly, in response to your comments, which are very well taken and very well said, the way that Congress is going to figure this out, members of Congress is going to figure this out, is when they hear from us, is when enough of us talk with them. And that means showing up at their meetings. It means showing up even at the party meetings that the individual members of Congress may not be at. They're listening to their party. Trust me. Join the county Democratic Party or the county Green Party or the county Republican Party. You know, just show up at the meetings, participate, and speak out. Word will get to them. This is how it works. We don't elect leaders here in the United States. We elect representatives. They are there to represent us, but they can't represent us if they don't know how we feel. And they're not listening to talk radio by and large. They're checking out their email. Well, actually, not even so much email now because they're afraid of spam. They're listening to the calls that come into their offices and the people who show up at their meetings. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Yeah, that's what it's all about, talk radio. Figuring out, you know, where we're at on some of these issues. What's the future of this country going to be? What kind of life do we want to have? What kind of world do we want to live in? What kind of nation do we want to live in? Who are we as a people? What is America? What is it all founded on? Yeah, we'll continue with our conversation of these many issues in just a few minutes. Right now, Alan Ratner is with us from the Talk Radio News Service with our daily report from Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Alan.
Well, the president was in Canada this morning, and as you know, the president of Mexico was there as well as the prime minister of Canada, and the president was completely supporting, as I call it, NAFTA Shafta, defending it. talking about how the trade rose from $293 billion to $883 billion, that there will be more prosperity. And then, of course, Secretary Paulson said today that the economy will weather this this crisis. Also, this is at the same time that the Senate Democratic Campaign Committee is essentially saying that the American economy, the middle class is getting 1% at the very minimum less in their paycheck than they were 5 years ago.
Right. It's paychecks have been slipping basically ever since Bush came into office and did his tax cuts and conservative economic voodoo economics, Reagan economics.
But so there you have it, defending NAFTA till the cows come home. And as you know, there are several trade agreements that the Bush administration has negotiated, and it looks like some of the Democrats at least are going to have the guts to not vote for it and also not to give the president fast-track authority on that.
Yeah, very interesting. Do you have any insight or any – I know that you know a lot of many members of Congress, you know, personally, and often – you're able to offer insights that are not, you know, the top of the news without naming names. As to how Congress, I'm thinking particularly of Pat Leahy, but obviously he's not the only member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And then you've got John Conyers with the House Judiciary Committee, which has already issued a contempt citation or said that they're going to. I forget which. It still has to go to the full, you know, House. You know, how this stuff is going to play out and how quickly and how aggressive they're going to get. I mean, are they back in the districts, are they really feeling the heat?
Well, I think it really depends how aggressive the White House gets as to what happens. Is the White House going to be even moderately cooperative, at least, you know, giving them a few little carrots? It doesn't help that the Washington Post actually found out that the Vice President's office acknowledged for the first time, and this was done yesterday, that it is dozens of documents related to the warrantless wiretap surveillance program and that it's going to resist it. So here you at least have them now admitting that they have some of this stuff. And now there's, and apparently also, of course, they're going to use this very novel idea. I always have this picture of these guys high-fiving it in the middle of the night and ordering pizza in Cheney's office when they come up with this scheme to say that he is president of the Senate as well as a member of the executive branch, that he's some kind of hybrid.
Right. There are four branches of government. There's the executive, the legislative, the judicial, and the dick branch.
That's marvelous. Exactly. And so what I think is going to go on is they're going to play this sort of cat and mouse game. And at some point, you know, Leahy does not, he doesn't have to worry in this sort of district by district thing that perhaps some of members of the House do. He's very secure in Vermont. And don't forget, that's the one state the President of the United States has not visited yet.
Hmm.
And I think Bernie Sanders, you'll have to ask him about it, has something on his webpage that points to Vermont and says, Mr. President, here it is.
Yeah. But it's also the one state that has, I think, close to or maybe over 200 different communities that have passed impeachment resolutions. I mean, it's pretty startling, the number.
Right. So I don't think he's, I think that Vermont will be last and maybe never.
Yeah, I've lived in both Vermont and New Hampshire. And in New Hampshire, the state where it says live free or die on the license plates that are stamped by guys in prison, in New Hampshire, they refer to Vermont as the People's Republic of Vermont.
Right, exactly. So I think that it is really going to depend what they figure that the vice president's office.
Ellen? Alberto Gonzalez got her. Yep. I think Alberto got her. There she goes. What a shame. Just as she was about to tell us the great secret, and I know it was the great secret, right? Just as she was about to tell us the great secret, there goes Ellen. Anthony in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Anthony, welcome to the program. What's up?
Oh, hey, Tom. Sorry that Ellen went away. I just wanted to briefly mention, yes, I have followed your advice. I was elected the precinct committee officer for my North Seattle area neighborhood. And
good on you, Anthony.
I've been working diligently, you know, getting the neighborhood, backing progressives and whatnot. I just wanted to say that a couple things, just number one, yesterday you were talking about, and actually this morning, what's her name, Marjorie Cohen.
Marjorie Cohen. Yeah.
She was talking about Democrats with no spine. Well, I contacted my congressperson, who is just a Democrat, but he's just one of those worthless Democrats. His name is Rick Larson. He represents the area north of Seattle here, the 2nd Congressional District.
There are no really worthless Democrats. There are just some who are not.
Well,
as
he
good
voted
as
for
others.
The bankruptcy legislation. I mean, I could go on and
okay,
on.
Okay, all right.
Anyway, so both he, Jay Inslee, and Adam Smith, all Democrats from this Seattle congressional area, they all. I called all their offices yesterday, and none of them are endorsing H.R. 333.
Right. Now, this is Kucinich's impeached Cheney bill.
And can I just briefly say one last thing?
If it's less than 10 seconds.
Okay, Bush is going to be in Seattle Monday, August 27th at the Bellevue Hyatt. Everyone come out and protest this guy.
Okay, Anthony, thanks a lot for the call. And good on you for joining the party and getting active. And our apologies to Ellen Ratner. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Program on Air America Radio, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Welcome back, my friends. Sometimes you wonder, where does all this news come from? Not like, you know, who's out there doing things, but I mean, how does it get into our TV sets? And I don't mean, you know, those little people who are dancing around the back of the TV set, throwing things up and painting the screen. In the case of CNN, for example, here's CNN telling us where they get their news from.
We've got generals, and if you ask them about the prospects for war with Iraq, they think it is almost certain.
That, I believe, Aaron Brown from CNN saying, we've got
generals. Jeff Cohen is with us. He is a former producer of The Donahue Show, media critic, author of Cable News Confidential, founder of FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.org. His website, Jeff Cohen, Cohen.org. Jeff Cohen, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be with you.
Always great to talk with you, Jeff. That was Aaron Brown, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Why would any reputable journalist, and Aaron Brown, frankly, is one of the guys that I have a lot of respect for, why would any reputable journalist say, we've got generals and they're telling us whatever they're telling us?
Well, I just think there's this sense that the job of mainstream journalism is to transmit to the public what the elites think. Instead of judging it, questioning it, challenging it, it's more a transmission belt. The latest controversy, and it comes right after that clip, this new documentary, War Made Easy, has this clip of the head of CNN going on the air, Ethan Jordan,
right,
and saying, here's the exact quote, "I went to the Pentagon myself several times before the war started and met with important people there and said, for instance, at CNN, here are the generals we're thinking of retaining to advise us on the air and off about the war. We got a big thumbs up on all of them. That was important," unquote. So,
wow.
So here you have Ethan Jordan, the head of CNN at the time, basically saying he consulted with the Pentagon and got a thumbs up on the people that appeared on the air. And, we know that most of what we were told by the retired generals who dominated coverage in the run-up to the war, the former CIA officials, the alleged weapons of mass destruction experts, most of what they told us was wrong.
Yeah.
And yet, here they are going to the Pentagon to consult on who those individuals will be. The question I
and think, they're continuing to be the same people who are telling us new things. I mean, now it's Iran, Syria yesterday.
And again, these people are never questioned. I mean, one of the big promoters of the war on CNN, one of their weapons experts, was the former CIA officer Kenneth Pollack.
Right.
He's not probed on how he got it all wrong.
Well, in fact, now he's running around saying, everything's going great in Iraq, and by the way, I used to be opposed to it.
Right.
What?
I mean, talk about the level of dishonesty. And then you have, General Barry McCaffrey, who's the top military analyst today for NBC and MSNBC. He got it all wrong when he was pushing for the invasion of Iraq.
But he looks so good on TV, Jeff.
Yeah, he's so military.
He's got that square jaw. He's a handsome guy. I mean, that,
Yeah, it's central casting.
There you go.
But, when you think about it, at least, and people are sometimes making fun of all these Democratic debates and forums, at least Hillary Clinton and the other senators who enabled the invasion of Iraq, at least they get probed from the stage and from the audience about how they got it wrong. These people in the corporate mainstream media who promoted the war, whether they were on-air anchors or so-called experts, retired generals, former CIA officials, former State Department officials, they're never probed.
Right.
Being a TV expert means never having to say you're sorry.
Well, isn't that to some extent because a lot of these guys are actually on salary with the networks, and the networks don't want to jeopardize that relationship, particularly with somebody who's highly telegenic?
Yeah, no doubt about it. They get paid a huge amount of money. General McCaffrey, I'd love to know what he earns for being NBC.
My guess would be that it's somewhere between a quarter and a half million a year. Do you think that's probably reasonable?
I don't know. When I was at Fox News, I was a paid pundit. I was getting $750 for each appearance, and I was the lowest guy on the totem pole.
Yeah.
So, some of these people have to be making $1,000, $1,500, $2,000 basically each time they go on. And that's a pretty penny for 10 minutes of work.
Right.
So you're right. It's the whole system is corrupt. But when I think about how, the Ethan Jordan, from CNN getting a thumbs up on these military analysts, it makes me think how it would be inconceivable if the story were something other than war or military. Imagine that the top story facing journalism was not a war, but it was, say, a big labor dispute. Can you imagine a network executive getting all of their experts from recently retired union officials who are somehow given a thumbs up by the current labor leadership that's leading the strike?
That ain't going to happen.
Yeah, it's not, because it would be seen as, biased, as inadequate, incomplete.
Right.
But when they cover war and foreign policy, they go to the same elite that is so tied to the war-making elite. You know, they go to the past war-making elite that's tied to the current war-making elite, and they pretend that's journalism at CNN.
Jeff, I remember a week or so after Bush was installed as president by the Supreme Court in 2001, in January 2001,
yep.
seeing a little, you know, four-column-inch article. I believe it was an AP article. I may well be wrong. It was in the our local paper in Vermont. I was living in Montpelier, Vermont at the time. It was in the Times Argus. And it was about how one of the senior executives at CNN, and I to this day, here it is, you know, 6 years later,
right.
going on 7 years later, I'm still kicking myself for not having torn that damn thing out, how one of the senior executives at CNN was making a pilgrimage to Washington, D.C.,
yeah.
to apologize to George Bush for portraying him as a doofus during the election and to assure him that they would portray him in a more positive light in the future, you know, because he's the president and they have great respect for the office of the president. And first of all, do you have a recollection?
Yeah, I know exactly what it was. You're referring to Walter Isaacson. He had just become the chair of CNN. And what he was doing was he was going to Capitol Hill for private, it's in my book, for private meetings with GOP leaders about complaints that CNN had been unfair, not just to Bush, had been unfair to conservatives. And Isaacson was quoted, "I wanted to hear their concerns." And then you had a top Republican staffer who quoted Isaacson as telling them at the meeting, "We want to change CNN's culture. Give us guidance on how to attract conservatives."
And so now they have Glenn Beck.
Yeah, again, it's all pitiful. Glenn Beck's got horrible ratings. He's a blowhard pushing for military confrontation with Iran. Many of the people in today's media pushing for confrontation with Iran were the ones who were totally wrong about Iraq. They know very little about the Middle East, but there's almost no challenge. I mean, when's the last time you've seen Juan Cole on national TV?
Yeah,
when's the last
brilliant.
Time yeah.
When was the last time I saw Jeff Cohen? I mean, you used to be on all the time.
I'm on some sort of list. Phil yeah. Donahue was completely correct about the dangers of invading Iraq. He's basically banished from TV.
Right.
Scott Ritter, a UN weapons inspector former who actually got it right. He's
right.
virtually banished.
And a Marine.
Yeah.
So, Jeff, when did this start, and how do we fix it in the minute and a half or so that we
right.
have left
I
to
mean,
solve the problems of the world?
Yeah, if you see, the new documentary that's out, War Made Easy, shows that it didn't just start. That, you know, this has been going on since Vietnam, where the media have been colluding.
Well, it goes back before that. I mean, Herbert Hoover, after World War I, was complaining about Woodrow Wilson using PR to sell World War I.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it goes back. But I think the way to challenge it is the way we are challenging it and the way Air America is challenging it. We forced Eason Jordan to explain, you know, he claims now this last week, "I wasn't vetting these people with the military for their political views, just their military expertise," which is laughable. But the fact is that we could get Eason Jordan to comment shows that the independent media is more powerful. There's the new documentary. There's independent outlets that were pushing this new documentary, War Made Easy. You've got talk shows, blogs, websites. That's the good news, that we're able to challenge in real time what the corporate mainstream media are doing. Obviously,
right.
Media Watch groups like FAIR and Media Matters. The good news is that there is a bustling, booming independent media that people have turned to, and there's never been a bigger migration away from corporate mainstream media to the independent as during the run-up to the war in Iraq and,
right.
and the years that have
and, and now that we're going into the election.
It's
sites
great.
From BuzzFlash to Common Dreams to Think Progress. I mean, it's just a whole collection of them that are just getting, you know, Raw Story, Crooks and Liars, etc., and fair.org as well, and hopefully jeffcohen.org will get more. Jeff Cohen, the media critic, author of Cable News Confidential, and just absolute genius on the media. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
You better watch your step.
Because Gonzalez is watching. Especially if you're a Democrat. Look out! Me. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here. We're with you 21 minutes past the hour. You know, there are times when it's like, this is incredible. You know, there are times when callers call in and they're expressing despair. I mean, just, you know, oh, my God, it's just, keep in mind, times have been worse. We had the Alien and Sedition Acts in 1798. We had the Alien and Sedition Acts during World War One. We had the McCarthy era. I mean, we have had times in the United States when the Reich has been, frankly, far more powerful than they are now, and the populace has been far less awake than they are now. And that's, I think, a really important carry-home message from Jeff Cohen's, you know, conversation with us, is that, yeah, I mean, he actually got Eason Jordan to respond. It's a great thing. It's a really great thing. So, anyhow, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Alex in Marietta, Georgia. Hey, Alex, welcome to the program. What's up?
Okay, Tom, how you doing?
Great.
You know, I used to, you know, 69 used to have y'all on the radio down here. They quit carrying y'all, and I've been stuck with Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh.
I'm sorry to hear that, Alex.
Yeah, I am sorry too. I don't like them, but I do listen to them now and then. But what I want to really talk to you about is, I'm not really satisfied with the Democrats right now, but they still a whole lot better than Republicans. I'm still sticking with them, and I wish Al Gore would get in.
I do too. I don't think he's going to though.
I
introduced him and moderated a question and answer session with him when he spoke at the Rose Garden in Atlanta 6-8 months ago. Did his Inconvenient Truth tour, and talked with him off stage and on, and this topic came up, and he was pretty clear that, you know, although he hadn't made a decision, that he was tending toward the negative. And I really think he's been there, he's done that, he got beaten up pretty badly, and criminally, frankly, and that he's not inclined to do it again. Although,
yeah,
if Al Gore were to decide to run for president again, I would just about lay down in front of a train, you know, on his behalf. I mean, I'd do just about anything.
I would. I'm with you. I don't think he will. I'm, you know, if Hillary's the nominee for Democratic Party, I'm voting for her.
Yeah, me too.
But you know, I wish someone else would be there, but.
Well, we'll see.
Better with Republicans now, but Lassie is better than Republicans.
There you go. Alex, thanks a lot for the call and for your comments.
All right, thank you, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome. What I find interesting are these polls where they're testing the Democratic field against any Republican. And they're asking not Democrats, but, you know, independent voters and voters right across the spectrum. And what they find is that of the three leading Democrats, Obama, Clinton, and Edwards, that Edwards is the most likely candidate to beat any Republican of any, regardless of who it is, more than 10%. And Obama and Hillary Clinton are in a close heat for the second place in that, but it's, you know, 3-5%. It's a whole lot tighter when it's one of them. And frankly, I think it's because John Edwards is the most progressive of the three. And, you know, unfortunately, Dennis Kucinich doesn't show up real high in those pollings, which is a tragedy. His positions are great. But of the three leading candidates, John Edwards is the most progressive. And interestingly, he's the one who's most likely to beat a Republican. And I think that that's one of the reasons why the Republicans are so aggressive in promoting the candidacy of the other two, because they think they can beat them. That's just my take on it. Bill in Superior, Colorado. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I've got a question. I saw a little blurb about $1 billion was being allocated for hiring private intelligence company.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for it is that the core of the CIA had been recruited by private industry.
Right.
And so the question I have is, since this is a fairly defined group of people, and I don't think there's a lot of work out there for independents, Did they know that there was going to be a contract and, you know, in the works? And they're basically just a placement agency.
Yeah, this is the insanity of outsourcing government functions to non-governmental agencies. This began with Reagan. It stepped up a little bit under Bush Sr. It was more or less put on hold through the Clinton administration, and then it went on to crack cocaine here under George W. And it's absolutely wrong. And what you have, you're absolutely right, what you have is government employees doing good and important work, like CIA officers, who discover that they can make so much more money working for a private corporation. Why? Because the Bush administration is hiring private corporations at much higher pay rates, saying that they're more efficient. They pay them a whole lot more, and so we end up with, you know, with private companies having our secrets. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
What is this, Alberto Gonzalez's new song? 34 minutes past the hour. I used to love that song by Johnny Cash until I saw somebody use it as a theme song for a hemorrhoid commercial. Just blew it for me. No pun intended. Anyway, 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Lauren's giving me that look. Oh, how could you have said that? Yeah, I know. Anyhow, Len in New York City. Hey, Len, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm fine, but I'll get better. What's up?
I listened to your callers today, and it just reminded me that, you know, when Republicans throw back at you, well, yeah, Bush's ratings are low, but Congress is even lower, that, you know, so many of us are just... are Democrats upset with the fact that Congress hasn't done enough to push back on the, I don't know, I don't want to use an obscenity. The retort to that would be that, there are a lot of Democrats upset with Congress, but, before they'd vote for a Republican, they'd watch Cheney and George Sr. skydiving together.
Yeah.
Which is just another way of saying, when pigs fly.
Yeah, yeah. And the reality is that Congress actually has done a lot. This Democratic Congress has done a lot. And tragically, so much of what they have done has been blocked by Republican filibusters in the Senate, has been blocked by veto threats from Bush or actual vetoes, or has been blocked by legal maneuvering in the House of Representatives. Most of it in the Senate, though. You know, at least 40 pieces of legislation, and if my memory serves me right, over 70 have now been blocked by the GOP. And the message, the one area where I would criticize the Democrats is not in that they haven't tried to get this stuff done, but that they haven't raised absolute hell to the point that everybody in America knows that it's Republican obstructionism, not Democratic failure to act. Now, there are areas where they have failed to act. I'd like to see them act, like, for example, inherent contempt and the possibility of impeachment proceedings, at the very least, against Gonzalez. And perhaps that'll happen when they come back in the fall. We'll see. Randall in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Randall.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to talk about the 90% tax. I'd called a couple of months ago or so about that. And to me, we're always talking about corporations, but it's the CEOs that are the problem, not the companies. Enron would have never happened if we had had that 90% tax. And
you're talking about the top marginal income tax rate,
right,
after you earn $3.2 million,
right,
in today's dollars being,
yeah,
90%, which is what it was from the mid-1930s or the late 1930s up until Kennedy dropped it down to 71% and then Reagan dropped it to 27%, as I recall, or 29%.
Yeah, well, it would have kept it in check. You wouldn't have baseball players making what it is, and inflation wouldn't be where it's at,
right,
or anything
the
else.
The economy wouldn't have gone nuts
destroyed
the middle class.
These generals wouldn't be going to these companies making these obscene salaries and that stuff as if.
Yep.
So I think that's what really is the stem, because it caused them to steal. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, well said, Randall. Very well said. Thank you very much. Steve in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Tom. How's it going?
Fine. What's up?
I just wanted to raise a quick point. The thing that scares me is I don't think along the lines of a lot of other people as far as what's been going on with our representatives, the Democratic representatives. Like you said, I'm unhappy that, you know, I'm happy with a lot of the things they have done, but there have been many key things that they have not pushed against. They've not shown their outrage. They haven't called the Republicans on the things they were doing wrong, and they've caved in a couple times.
Well, you know, Steve, a lot of the time they have, and it simply doesn't get covered. Okay. I mean, I get these news releases all the time. I get them from both the Republicans and the Democrats, and the Republican ones get picked up on the mainstream press, and the Democratic ones don't. It's startling. The ones I get from Waxman's office, from Harry Reid's office, it's sometimes they are really taking names and kicking butt, and it just doesn't appear in the mainstream media. And then I get some, you know, I get a press release from some Republican's office, and predictably that's the thing that they're talking about on Hardball at night.
Well, my concern is not that, you know, it's, well, we're going to vote for the Democrat, whoever he or she may be, that, you know, starts running. My fear is that because most of the people that I talk to who are active are disgusted, and it's just over these main issues. It's not, I'm not worried that, you know, they'll just go out and vote anyway. My worry is that they won't vote. They just won't get out and vote.
Well, and that's the strategy of driving down the vote, and it's the strategy that Richard Viguerie talks about.
We have to fight this media saturation with, you know, the Republican point of view. Somehow it's got to be done.
Yeah, and it'll be done by enough of us speaking up and enough of us saying to the media, enough already. I'd like to hear from the other side. Thank you very much. What happened to Katrina VandeHeuvel on the radio or on television, on, you know, as a commentator? I'd like to see Amy Goodman once in a while. Amy Goodman's one of my heroes. She is one of the most brilliant journalists, and she's an actual journalist. She's not a commentator like I am. She's a real journalist, one of the most brilliant journalists in America. Why is she not being brought on to comment on the news? Because, I mean, if anybody knows the news, Amy Goodman knows the news. I mean, why not? And you know, we need to be, frankly, saying, you know, this is, I realize, counter to my, you know, you don't vote with your dollars because that's not democracy. But nonetheless, we need to be speaking back to our media aggressively, and as well as to our elected representatives. We need to be doing it. And we need to be out there, and we need to be getting active. And getting active, by the way, there's a whole variety of ways of getting active. For example, you can go over to airamerica.com and participate in our blog. I just posted a blog there about what's going on in Minneapolis, and you can participate there. And also, just a quick reminder, at 9 o'clock tonight here in New York City, I'll be at the Tank. This is for Screening Liberally, screeningliberally.org, their website. And we will be discussing Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour. It's at 279 Church Street for our listeners in WWRL, or however you may be hearing our show here in Manhattan. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, you've got so many Jeffs calling in now. You've got multiple Jeffs. Maybe you need to number us.
I guess. You're Jeff number one, I guarantee
you.
You've been Jeff number one for what, 4 years you've been listening? 5 years?
Since you're on IE America.
Yeah, 5 years now. So,
I think until we really, citizens get out and actually meet with the representatives, attend public meetings and such, they really don't have much to complain about. You know, you go to these meetings, the same old faces over and over again. Last week we had a meeting with at our congressional office, and they were just wonderful people. It was really nice. We got listened to. We had a really good discussion. And one of the problems, though, right now is, like with impeachment, you find a lot of the people who work for these representatives, representatives themselves may agree with us on most things, but we have no leaders. I mean, it's like I say, well, you hear sometimes terms of focus groups or polls or something like that. Can you imagine if Buddha or Gandhi or Jefferson or Jesus did focus groups and polls?
Right.
Yeah, we need, it's like, damn the pollsters, full speed ahead. We need real leaders. We have Kucinich. And all these guys are always testing the wind. We have a circular thing where everybody's following the followers.
Yeah. Well, see, Jeff, that's because we are the leaders in this country, and we have to get out there and lead, and we have to push, push, push. And eventually it will work. It always has.
Yeah. Go to public meetings. Go talk directly with your representatives. There are some representatives, you know, that we go talk to sometimes. They say, no one has ever come in here.
Yeah.
We have various levels of government. They, like, we're some of the first people ever.
Oh, that's great. I mean, it's terrible that you're the first people ever, but it's great that you showed up.
Yeah, I remember one time
representative called me up and just said, hey, you're the first person. He called me back personally to thank me for thanking him.
Wow.
Because he just had heard so few people from that issue.
Right. So so people need to be contacting their members of Congress.
All the time. Don't vote, if you don't talk to those people, how are they supposed to represent you if you don't talk to them?
Right. Well said. Jeff, thank you very much for the call, and always great to hear from you.
Take care.
You too. Dan in San Diego, California. Hey, Dan, listening on KLSD. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Oh, the earlier caller who talked about I wish Gore would run. I mean, and I think people keep getting on about that, but that ship has sailed. But beyond that, I don't think Gore can win. He just doesn't have that. He's not quick on his feet, and he doesn't have the go for the jugular instinct that it takes to win. And
except that he did win. You know, I mean, when they actually, a year later, when the media consortium of the New York Times and the Washington Post and USA Today and all that, they actually went down to Florida and they took those semi-trailer trucks up to New York, and they actually counted the ballots. And it was reported on September 12th or 13th, as I recall. I've got the story on my computer here. In 2002, reported in the New York Times, it was buried in the 17th paragraph. I mean, they buried the lead. But they said that by any measure, hanging chads, pregnant chads, intended voter, overvoters, undervoters, non-intended voters, whatever, by any measure, if you counted all the votes in the state of Florida, which is what the Florida Supreme Court required, which is what Bush went to the U.S. Supreme Court to stop the count, if you counted all the votes in Florida, Al Gore won Florida. Al Gore is the rightfully elected president of the United States in 2000, or was. And you know, the guy sitting in there now is the squatter in chief, and several of the members of the Supreme Court at that time, Scalia and Rehnquist, as I recall specifically, had members of their families working on the Bush campaign. They should have recused themselves, but this bizarre 5-4 decision. So A, I don't agree that Al Gore is too nice to win, because A, he already has won, and B, you know, he's a competent and seasoned politician. He's won a hell of a lot of races, including, you know, vice president of the United States twice. I just don't think he's going to run is, you know, the bottom line for me. So anyway, we'll see how it shakes out. We'll see how it shakes out. Hope springs eternal, which is not to say, I mean, there's other good candidates out there. One of the most important points, I made this last night at the 11th hour screening here in Manhattan at the Landmark Sunshine down in the East Village, is that it's not about the candidates. It's about us. It's never been about the candidates in the United States. It's always been about us. If we get active, 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
If I were a carpenter and you were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby?
If you were a carpenter and I were a lady, I'd marry you anyway. I'd have your baby.
If a tinker was my trade, would I still find you?
I'd be carrying the pots you made, following behind you.
Say my love. Given you my loneliness, you'll be yours tomorrow.
I could listen to Willie Nelson all day long. Back 9 minutes before the hour. Okay, here it is, our historical quote for the day. The most fascinating historical quote that was actually never said. This is flying all over the blogosphere. I've had 20 people email it to me. And, you know, I'm sorry, you go over to Snopes.com, it's been debunked. This was not part of the Ronald Reagan diaries. But what's so interesting is that so many people think it was, because it makes such perfect sense that it would be. This is the current, you know, thing that's flying around the current viral email. It's supposedly from Ronald Reagan in his recently published diaries, May 17th, 1986. Ronald Reagan writing in his diary, quote, "A moment I've been dreading. George brought his ne'er-do-well son around this morning and asked me to find the kid a job. Not the political one who lives in Florida, the one who hangs around here all the time looking shiftless. This so-called kid is already almost 40 and has never had a real job. Maybe I'll call Kinsley over at the New Republic and see if they'll hire him as a contributing editor or something. That looks like easy work." End quote. But it's not a real quote. So before you send it to 50 friends going, "Holy cow, look at this," don't bother. There's enough, you know, real bizarre stuff out there. Yeah, really bizarre stuff. Will in Manhattan. Hey, Will, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm just kind of curious. You know, you're telling people to look to grassroots and take that as a strategy. But, I mean, can you also go a step further and say, but listen, you also might be spied on the entire way? I mean, the next election is coming up down the road.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the Democrats, they signed on with Bush to you know, legalize additional spying. So how
the Democrats did not sign on with Bush for this. The majority of the Democrats voted against it. 16
uh-huh.
Democrats in the Senate and 41 Democrats in the House voted for it.
Whatever.
So it's not. We've got to stop saying the Democrats. We've got to start saying a few Democrats. And they frankly, from what I'm hearing, they're getting hell in their districts this summer.
Okay, I mean, does that mean that it's not going to be happening? It's we're not going to be spying on, even if we're. You know?
Oh, I think they've been spying on us all along. I mean,
yeah.
As we were talking with Ellen Ratner about an hour and a half ago, you know, with the news, this is just the tip of the iceberg. This so-called terrorist surveillance program.
Exactly.
There's all this spying stuff that's going on that we have no clue about yet. I mean, I agree with you that they are spying on us and. At a certain point, you just have to say, damn it, I'm not going to be afraid. I'm not going to be afraid of Osama bin Laden. I'm not going to be afraid of, you know, the Muslims. I'm not going to be afraid of the brown people coming from Mexico. I'm not going to be afraid. I mean, all those things out there, the fear. And I'm not going to be afraid of the Bushies and of this government. I'm just not going to be afraid anymore. This is a great country. It was founded on the principle of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, not cowering in fear. And throughout the history of this country, we have followed that, with those principles. By the way, I just want to add one point to what I said. And in fact, somebody in the chat room said, Tom, you know, so right on that. This is a point I made last night at one of the 11th hour gigs. And I think it's such an important point. Abraham Lincoln was not elected to end slavery. Teddy Roosevelt was not elected to break up the big corporations. Franklin Roosevelt was not elected to give labor a voice, to put in Social Security, and to pass all the progressive reforms that created the American middle class. Lyndon Johnson rose to power. The guy who passed the most sweeping and positive and powerful civil rights legislation, who signed it into law and worked hard to get it passed in the entire 20th century. Lyndon Johnson rose to power in Texas as a right-wing racist, basically candidate of the crackers. None of these guys who positively transformed America, none of them were perceived by the voters or at the time as the person who was going to really change things. Teddy Roosevelt ran as the vice presidential candidate for McKinley as the rich white guy representing rich white guys in their corporate interests. And what did he do? He busted up the corporations. One of the most progressive presidents we ever had. Franklin Roosevelt ran a very, very modest campaign, a very moderate, let's not rock the boat in 1932 campaign. Yeah, he sure got on his high horse in the 36 campaign, but in the 32 campaign, in the first campaign, it would have made Hillary Clinton look radical. Keep in mind, it's not the candidate. It's not the person. Yeah, of course we want a good person. We want the person, perfect person. Wouldn't that be great? But it's the people. In every case, these presidents, and there's a thousand examples of senators and members of Congress, in every case, they responded to the people pushing them. And that's why we need to be out there and be pushing our politicians. Maureen in Seattle. Hey, Maureen.
Hi, Tom. I just want to thank you for what you're saying and how important it is that we don't remain afraid. There's plenty to be afraid of, but we need to push back that and use our anger and frustration to be involved. And I think it's with all the challenges that people around the world face every day to that requires perseverance, it would be arrogant of us as Americans to say that because the going is tough right now that we're going to just give up. That is not in our blood. It's not in our country. And we just need to know that we have the strength and find the courage to put this country back together and be a part of it.
Well said, Maureen. Thank you. We are Americans. We are Americans. We are not afraid. We will take this country back. Coming up tomorrow, I will be debating Herman Cain, conservative radio talk show host, about some of the issues of the day. Our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment. David Childress is here. about how Maverick sea captains were members of the Knights Templar. Don't go to KnightsTemplar.com, by the way. Very dangerous website. Larry Scott with the VAWatchdog.org and more. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at AirAmericaRadio.com.